It's time to go back to school with Professor Fish, America's only show dedicated to college athletics on a national level.
Ah, man, I think the clock is slow.
University of Fish. Class is now in session.
I don't feel tardy.
Here's the professor, Tim Fisher.
Welcome to the University of Fish. I am the professor, Tim Fisher. We are getting ever closer to college football. Today, what we're going to do, we're going to break down numbers 25 through 21 in Professor Fish's top 25 preseason poll. It may not be exactly like you see everywhere else. It then again may have a lot of similarities because when you rank teams, that's how they come out, because everybody thinks the same thing about all the same teams. We'll be talking with people, the beat writers from these schools, talking about their schools and what they expect from the teams this year. We'll do that for everyone from 1 through 25. So today, 25 through 21, we'll also be paying tribute to Coach Ara Parseghian, who we lost earlier this week. The Notre Dame coach brought him back to notoriety, won a few national championships with him there, had Joe Theismann as one of his players, had a lot of great players, also had one little kid who thought he could play and walked on. Of course, I'm talking about Rudy Rudiger, immortalized in the movie Rudy. We're going to be talking to him as well, Rudy, on the show today. But we've got to start off with everything, all the news that's going on in the University of Fish and throughout the NCAA. We're going to start off with Florida State. This happened just yesterday. Devontae Phillips, a receiver for Florida State, he is facing 5 felony charges for cashing or depositing items with intent to defraud and grand theft. This according to court records that was obtained by the Tallahassee Democrat yesterday. He played in 9 games last season and was expected to play a key role at a very thin receiver position for the Florida State Seminoles, and they're starting out tough against the University of Alabama. We'll talk Alabama in just a second, but right now about Devontae Phillips. He's going to see a judge today, and according to the court records, he bought 4 money orders for $485.89. Kind of an odd number, but then he altered them each to the amount of $700, a difference of, do the math, $2,314.11. Then what'd he do? This is where he messed up. Well, he messed up doing that in the first place. He deposited them into his bank account. And then after they hit, he went and took the money out of an ATM, saying afterwards that his account had been hacked, that somebody had his wallet and he didn't do it, saying that this happened back in February. And now players say they need to get paid. He's trying to pay himself. And so he's looking at 14 charges, 4 of them for $700. The others, you know, from $108 to $101. This guy's going to get in trouble because we're looking at multiple accounts. We're looking at 5 felony charges for Devontae Phillips. We'll have to see what Coach Jimbo Fisher does. Is he going to say, okay, we'll let to see what the courts do before we do anything for this towards suspension or discipline throughout the school? So we'll see what happens. We'll keep you up to date on what's going to happen to Devontae Phillips. We already know what's going to happen to Deshaun Hand, defensive lineman for Alabama. Got caught, well, not drinking and driving. They say he was sleeping behind the wheel with the car running, radio on, in Tuscaloosa. And the first day of camp Thursday, Coach Saban you knew he was going to be asked, what are you going to do? Here's what he said. Deshaun put himself in a bad situation, obviously made a mistake being where he was at the time, but the fact that he didn't drive the car, which is up for suggestion, we'll talk about that in a second, which is what they tell the players not to do. It's not okay he was drinking with me, says Saban. That's a behavioral issue that needs to be addressed, and we'll address it. But the fact that he didn't drive the car, wasn't driving the car, didn't put others at risk, which to me is the most significant thing when you drive under the influence, but he didn't drive, the police had every right to do what they did, and they put him in, and they arrested him. They put him in a 48-hour inpatient treatment for assessment purposes. Professional people assess what he needs to do, what we need to do with him, and that's what we'll do with him. But because he put himself in the situation, we'll put him in community service, and if he does everything he's supposed to do, he will not be suspended, because we're doing is helping the player. Come on, Nick Saban. Seriously. Seriously. He was a number one recruit in the nation in 2014, had 21 tackles, 2 sacks last year, was expected to play, and is going to play a huge role in the Alabama defense this year. Now, they say he wasn't driving. When the police found him, he was passed out behind the wheel with a car running in a parking lot right by the bars there in Tuscaloosa. So, you can say, well, he wasn't driving, he was just sleeping it off before he went home. We don't know that. We don't know anything around this. So he could have actually been, hey, I'm out partying tonight. Okay, I can make it by last call. We've all done that, going, hey, we can make that last call run. And so he went to where the bars were, passed out then. So he could have been driving. In every state, it's called different things in different places, but it's actual physical control. If you've got the keys in ignition and you're drunk, no matter what, that is DUI. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it, but as Coach Saban has shown, he's a hard disciplinarian. You get kids busted with drugs and guns last year, and all that happened was nothing. You have a law enforcement officer saying, well, you know, we couldn't decide, and we didn't know whose gun it was, whose drugs it was, so we're not going to charge either one of them. And you don't know what these guys go through, you know, through junior high school, and college, out there in the hot sun sweating while we're all sitting in air conditioner. So they got off. They got off not serving one down of suspension. Now, if Alabama was opening against a Southeast Alabama school, the deaf, dumb, and blind, instead of a Florida State, you could see Saban possibly suspending Hand for maybe the first game, the first half, the first quarter, whatever. But because they're opening up with Florida State, you know Nick Saban's not going to do anything. Now, here's a player who did nothing wrong, but yet is being punished by the NCAA. UCF kicker loses a scholarship and eligibility for what? Having his YouTube account monetized. The guy makes creative videos. That's Donald Delahaye. He's a kicker for the Golden Knights, and you can't make money on YouTube if you're a college football player. He has 97,000 YouTube subscribers on his channel called Destroying. It's D-E-E, Stroying. Go check it out. He's got some great videos on there. The NCAA said, well, he can get his eligibility back. Not saying he can play, but he can continue to monetize his videos that do not reference him as a student athlete or depict his football skill or ability. So if he wanted to do trick kicks, you know, where he's kicking it off a wall or whatever, you know how they do some of those strange things on those videos, he can't do that. He cannot do anything that depicts his ability or skills. Poor kid. I mean, he has started a GoFundMe page to help pay his tuition since he lost his scholarship over this. And now, Oklahoma, got to talk about him. Lincoln Riley has came in and said, hey, I'm not going to run a program where people are just running amok, and he is already showing that because he released from the program. No, not released, dismissed from the program Chris Robinson. Chris Robinson is a 4-star quarterback recruit. I mean, the kid can play, but he is no longer with the team. He's from Mesquite, Texas, and he dismissed him. Why? For a violation of team rules, according to the statement put out by the school. Don't know what it was. In April, he was arrested for public intox and along with a walk-on defensive back, but that is not what happened. It was something else, a violation of team rules. Don't know what it was. Celebrated pro-style prospect at quarterback. And It shouldn't have any bearing on the depth chart this year because obviously Baker Mayfield's going to be your starter there, two-time Heisman finalist, and you've got the A&M transfer Kyler Murray, who is eligible after sitting out last year. So you've got quarterbacks already there. So it's not going to hurt them in depth, but it hurts the program as it was. So we'll have to see what's going to happen with Chris Robinson, see if he comes back to the team. And now one more example of where the NCAA is just stupid. Title IX came along, and it was supposed to be a really good thing, you know, for the equality of men's and women's sports, to protect the women, to do this, to do that. But now what the schools do is, if there's a criminal investigation, they let them do that. So like if a murder happens on campus, every single person who's ever been to the college anywhere, if the university did it alongside with the police, that wouldn't make sense, would it? So when there's an allegation of a crime, campus cops call real cops and they investigate. Matt Bormeister, he is the kicker for USC, made the winning kick in the Rose Bowl against Penn State. And so he is wrestling, roughhousing with his girlfriend, Zoe Katz. And a neighbor told his roommate, who told a coach in the athletic department, that he was abusing his girlfriend. So the coach reported the incident to the Title IX office. Now, this girlfriend was summoned to a mandatory meeting with the Title IX officials, and she said, and they were saying, well, you must be afraid of him. She said, she's not. He had not been arrested, not been charged with the crime. The police found nothing into this case, but Title IX said, you must be afraid of him. And what they did, she said she'd never been abused, assaulted, or otherwise mistreated, and the Title IX official made her feel misled, harassed, threatened, discriminated against, and caused her to hire an attorney. And so Matt Bormeister gets kicked off the team for a Title IX offense. Seriously. Because he's roughhousing, wrestling around with his girlfriend, and a nosy neighbor starts talking. So now the poor kid can't play football. Title IX needs to be fixed. If not fixed, it needs to be gotten rid of. Now, that's enough of the crime and punishment for this week. Well, I'm sure, thank you, college students, you will give us more crime and punishment to talk about next week. When we come back after this break, we're going to dive in to our top 25. Professor Fish's preseason top 25, 25 through 21. You'll find out who's number 25 right after the break. I am the Professor Tim Fisher. You're listening to the University of Fish on Extra Sports 1300.
Everyone, back in your seats. University of Fish is back in session.
Hi, this is Mac Engel, sports columnist from the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, and you are listening to the University of Fish.
Everybody has their own top 25 polls, and of course, the professor has his as well. We're going to start off where? With number 25, the University of South Florida. We're joined right now by Joey Knight with the Tampa Bay Times. Joey, how you doing?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Okay, you got a new coach, new system there at South Florida. What do you see from the team this year?
I see a very legitimate chance of this team running the table based on a couple of things. You've got a veteran quarterback, a fringe Heisman candidate in Quentin Flowers, a dual threat, a guy who posted well over 4,000 total yards last year, who has the complete and utmost confidence from all of his teammates, surrounded by a wealth of talent out wide and behind him in the backfield. You've got Charlie Strong, who was just, if there could have been an upgrade from Willie Taggart, who's now in the Power Five, they went out and found one in Charlie Strong, whose recruiting connections in the state of Florida go extremely deep, having spent so much time at the University of Florida as a coordinator for two national championship teams. And you have a schedule that is extremely favorable. That will come back to bite USF, if it has any kind of hope at all of trying to get a playoff spot, because the schedule is not very strong at all. But for their chances to run the table, it's very favorable. I could see this team if it has no hiccups, no significant injuries, getting into that that New Year's Six bowl spot that goes to the highest ranked group of five team.
Now, we know the offensive firepower. What's it like on the other side of the ball? How will the defense stop people?
This is something that's going to take time. Charlie Strong, you know, he earned his defensive chops at Florida, couldn't replicate that success at Texas, and he inherits a group that allowed nearly 6 yards per play last year, more than 480 yards a game. There's a lot of guys coming back. I believe there's 7 defensive starters, but they're very thin at linebacker. The only linebacker who has started a college game is the middle linebacker, senior Augie Sanchez, who will probably graduate as the program's all-time leading tackler, but he's the only one who has started a game. There's a few others that have played quite a bit, but ultimately the new coordinator, Brian Jean-Marie, would like to have, a 8-9-guy linebacker rotation just based on how quickly the offense is going to get off the field and the spread-style teams that they're going to face week in, week out in the American Athletic Conference. The defense is going to be on the field a lot. You need to rotate bodies, and they just don't have them at linebacker. So what this team is going to do this year is really rely on the offense to score a lot of points, and Charlie Strong and Brian Jean-Marie are just going to have to compensate defensively, disguise their weaknesses, you know, find some creative ways to replenish that linebacker core, especially when they face power teams.
All right, Joey Knight, glad talking to you today. Well, I'm sure we'll be talking to you throughout the season because USF is going to have a very good season, like you said, against some inferior opponents, but they're going to have a great season, do have that chance around the table. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Coming in at number 24 on the University of Fish preseason top 25 from the ACC, the Pittsburgh Panthers. We're joined right now by Jerry DePaula from the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Jerry, tell us about the Panthers.
Well, I had concerns about Pitt even before the events of the last few days, where Pat Narduzzi had to suspend 3 players, 2 for the first 3 games and 1 for the opener, and then he had to throw off a senior defensive end. These are 4 key players that would have helped on defense, and 1 as a guard on offense. He's only going to miss the Youngstown State games. That's Alex Book, so that's not a big deal. But losing Jordan Whitehead, the safety, you know, all second team all ACC safety, ACC Rookie of the Year 2 years ago, who was going to move to free safety this year to help to shore up Pitt's weak pass defense. He's suspended for the first 3 games, and so is Quentin Reginis, a senior linebacker who might have started at middle linebacker this year. Now, the thing about those first 3 games, 2 of them are against Penn State and Oklahoma State. So Pitt's going to struggle without those guys, and with the shadow of all these suspensions hanging over the team. The defense was going to be inexperienced anyway. It might be a little bit more athletic with some of the young guys are going to put in there, but I think Pitt's going to struggle because of the suspensions, because they're rebuilding their defense anyway.
How's the offense look this year?
Well, you know, they lost a lot, you know, off last year's team. And Nate Peterson, the quarterback, is with the Buffalo Bills. James Conner is with the Steelers. They lost the offensive coordinator, Matt Canada, to LSU. They lost 2 offensive linemen who went to the NFL. They're still going to be fairly good on the offensive line because they do have some experience coming back. Not much depth, but some pretty good experience, especially Brian O'Neill, who moves from right tackle to left tackle, and probably the best tackle in the ACC. And they do have a big weapon in Quadre Henderson, you know, return guy. He returned 3 touchdowns, 3 kicks for touchdowns last year. And then they returned Jester Wea at wide receiver. And Jester Wea, you know, was 2nd in the nation in yards per catch, 24.6 yards per catch last year. Sort of came out of nowhere as his breakout season at Pitt. He's back. Now, the quarterback situation is a little different. It's a lot different. They got Max Brown, the transfer from USC, 5-star quarterback coming out of high school in Washington State, went to USC, you know, didn't really do much there at all, got benched after 3 games last season for Sam Darnold, and that's really no sin because Darnold's probably, you know, the best quarterback in the Pac-12, if not the nation this year. But Max Brown is trying to, you know, transfer to Pitt for his final season and try to, you know, learn the offense in 1 year. There are going to be some growing pains. Like I said, the schedule is tough early on when they play Penn State and Oklahoma State. Maybe the ACC may not be as strong this year because North Carolina is going to be down, and Pitt doesn't play Clemson, Florida State, or Louisville. out of the ACC this year. So their schedule isn't that difficult. But still, I think Pitt's going to struggle just to reach eight wins this season, which is what they've gotten the first 2 years under Pat Narduzzi.
Thank you, Jerry DePaola from the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. We look forward to talking to you throughout the season as the Panthers move throughout the year. Coming in at number 23 on the University of Fish preseason top 25 countdown, the University of Tennessee Volunteers. We're joined by John Adams right now, Tennessee sports writer for the Knoxville News Sentinel. John, how you doing today?
Doing great.
Okay, so the Vols, you know, in a competitive SEC East, what do you think is going to happen this year?
Well, I think most people agree that Florida and Georgia, either one, is the favorite in the East. Tennessee is a consensus number three. That sounds about right. I mean, it's not out of the question Tennessee could win the division, but it could win the division last year when it had more talent. So I think it's reasonable to put Georgia and Florida ahead of it right now.
Everybody thinks about the quarterback position being the glory spot of the team. How do the Vols look this year at quarterback?
Well, they've got to get a replacement for Joshua Dobbs, and I think both of these guys, though, Quentin Dormandy has served only as a backup the past 2 years, and Jared Garantano is a redshirt freshman. These guys both have a lot of potential. Both were four-star recruits. Garantano didn't play against a high level of competition in high school, but he's a tremendous athlete. If you check out his high school video, you'll see a guy with great speed, open field running ability, tall, maybe a little slender, who could also throw the ball, has a very strong arm, very mobile, can throw on the run. Dormandy is more of a drop back passer, but he's not a statue back there. He can move around some. He, in fact, played against really stiff competition in Texas high school football at the highest level. And this guy, everybody that's seen him, we only are allowed to see practice when these guys are kind of limbering up, and we don't see them again in a full-scale scrimmage. But former players who have seen Dormandy all rave about his passing ability. I mean, I've just seen it very limited basis in a few roles last season as a backup, and in the spring game he was 10 for 10, which tells you something, though it's only spring football. But everybody that's seen this guy, former players, some former quarterbacks, love the way he throws the ball. He's very accurate, got a strong arm.
Now, you know, in the SEC you have to be able to play tough defense. What does the defense look like this year?
Well, that's the big question mark. Tennessee did not play anywhere near tough defense last season. Missouri got 740 yards on it last season. And Tennessee lost its best defensive player. Its three best defensive players, actually, the most noteworthy of which was All-American defensive end Derek Barnett. I really wonder about Tennessee's pass rush, and I wonder about its pass coverage. However, its defensive starting lineup is full of former four-star recruits. It's kind of perplexing why none of these guys have really shown up big yet based on their recruiting billing. Maybe this is the year they break out, but they got a lot of former four-star linemen and some guys in the secondary that were really rated highly by recruiting services. So there's at least potential. But that's the big question mark. Can these guys cover well enough, and can they mount a strong pass rush?
How hot is the seat under Coach Jones?
I'd say pretty hot. Right now, when I write that, a lot of fans complain. How can you say Butch Jones is on the hot seat after back-to-back 9-win season? The fans' tone will change if Tennessee loses the opener to Georgia Tech. The tone will change dramatically. Butch Jones has improved the program, no question about that. But this is Tennessee, not Kentucky, and he's in his fifth season. And the bad thing from his perspective is the SEC East is weaker than it's ever been, and in each of the past two seasons, Tennessee could have won the division. It was in the position to win it. It blew games it should have won. And if things go wrong this season, that will be at the forefront of a lot of people's minds. So I think that he's very – I mean, you see most preseason publications when they list coaches on the hot seat. A lot of them do. Butch Jones is right up there.
Coming in at number 22 on the University of Fish preseason top 25, the Washington State Cougars. And we're joined now by Stephanie Lowe of the Seattle Times. Stephanie, you cover the Cougars more than anybody else. What do you see going on with the Cougars this year?
Hi, thanks for having me. Well, first off, I think the Cougars are going into this year with the mindset that this could be a really special season for them. They have a lot of seniors coming back. It's a big senior class, and almost all of their seniors are starters. And so it feels like this is the season that they've been building toward ever since Mike Leach took that job in 2012. They were picked to finish third in the Pac-12 North, and I think most people would agree with that. But it's also not impossible that if they come out the gate strong and kind of keep that momentum going and have one of those charm seasons that you see a team have, you know, once every decade like that, that they could end up playing UW for the Pac-12 North title in the Apple Cup at the end of the season.
Okay, Stephanie, thank you for joining us this week on the University of Fish. Look forward to talking to you later in the season because I know the Cougars have big things in store for them.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Coming in at number 21 on the University of Fish preseason top 25 from the Big 12, the West Virginia Mountaineers. We're joined by Chris Anderson of 24/7. Chris, what has Dana Holgorsen got this year?
Well, he's got a lot of new parts on both sides of the ball. Offense, out are Skylar Howard, quarterback Skylar Howard, and his top two receivers. And in is Florida transfer Will Grier, who may be the most hyped quarterback West Virginia has seen since Geno Smith was running the show in Morgantown. He's got a lot of toys to play with, including former last year's Big 12 Offensive Newcomer of the Year and running back Justin Crawford. At wide receiver is former quarterback prodigy David Sills. I went to junior college for a year, tried his hand at quarterback again, and came back as a wide receiver and is one of the top targets for Grier. The offensive line, breaking in a couple new starters, but they're all guys back with experience, including left tackle Yadni Kajusti, who was the starter but went down with a knee injury in last year's season opener, causing him to miss the entire season. And according to the coaching staff, he is or could be the best lineman on this roster. So that's obviously a big addition that was missing last year. On the other side of the ball, defensive coordinator Tony Gibson is going to have to work his magic again. The Mountaineers are replacing 9 starters from last season, including, at least for the first couple games, linebacker David Long, who suffered a knee injury earlier this summer. Head coach Dana Holgorsen and the rest of the staff is pretty mum on exactly what it was, exactly how long he might be out. But I'm hearing, at least for the first couple of games, and the staff might take it easy so that he's fully healthy for Big 12 play. Speaking of injuries, Dravon Askew-Henry, safety, former freshman All-American, he missed all of last season due to a knee injury as well. He is back, fully healthy, going through practice, and is expected to be one of the stars of this defense and really fills up what is already a loaded safety position for West Virginia, really the only position group that has the experience you really want in the Big 12. You got Askew-Henry. Next to him is Kaiser White, who was recently one of the most NFL-ready players in the Big 12 and started all 12 games last year, his first in Morgantown. He is the younger brother of former first-round NFL pick Kevin White. And besides them, is likely Toyus Avery, a junior college transfer who filled in towards the end of last year and took over the starting role and is expected to keep it this season. Cornerback is really going to be the biggest question mark, almost an entire new two deep. The surprise of the spring is Hakeem Bailey, a junior college transfer who's only a sophomore, but came in January and immediately took over the starting role, impressed the coaching staff, and is expected to make a big difference this fall. And West Virginia will really need it in a pass-happy Big 12.
Do look forward to talking to you later in the season as we get into Big 12 play because the Mountaineers are going to have some big games.
All right, thank you. Anytime.
Now, next week here on the University of Fish, we're going to break down number 11 through number 20, the next 10 in Professor Fish's top 25 preseason poll, because we're getting that much closer to the season starting. Now, when we come back after this break, we're going to start talking about the loss of Ara Parseghian. Yes, it's a big loss in the college football. Hadn't coached for years, but he still left his mark. We're going to start off talking to a student at Notre Dame when Coach Parseghian was there. Then we're going to talk to a beat writer from South Bend. And then after that, Rudy Rudiger. That's right, the real Rudy, right here on the University of Fish. I'm the professor. We'll be right back.
Everyone, back in your seats. Professor Fish is giving a lecture.
This is Derek Wilburn, founder and chairman of the Rocky Mountain Black Conservatives, world-renowned, and you are listening to the other world-renowned University of Fish.
Welcome back to the University of Fish. I am the professor, Tim Fisher. Now, we did lose a coaching legend this past week, Ara Parseghian, who brought the Fighting Irish and Notre Dame back to prominence. We're going to let you talk to a few people who knew Coach Parseghian and worked with him. We are joined now by Colorado Springs Mayor John Southers, who, why am I talking to him on my college sports show? Because he was a student at Notre Dame as Ara Parseghian was finishing up his career there. Mayor Southers, how you doing this morning?
I'm doing great, Tim, but I was also, interestingly enough, on the front end of Ara's career, and let me explain that. I was a 12-year-old altar boy at St. Paul's Church in Colorado Springs, and on a Friday in September in 1964, I got a call from our pastor, Monsignor Harrington, and he said, would you like to serve at Mass tomorrow for the Notre Dame football team, who was making its first trip to Colorado Springs with its new coach, Ara Parseghian. And Notre Dame had a couple of rough years. They'd hired him from Northwestern, and they'd won their first two games rather convincingly over Wisconsin and Purdue. And they were coming for their first game of the Air Force Academy, and I was the altar boy and met that morning at church the new coach, Ara Parseghian, John Hewitt, Jack Snow. John Hewitt went on to win the Heisman Trophy that year, and they had a defensive lineman by the name of Alan Page, who turned out to be pretty good.
Yeah, Alan Page wasn't too bad. Is that what made you decide to go to Notre Dame?
You know, it had a lot to do with it. Father Harrington was a Irish, actually he's from Ireland, and as far as he was concerned, there was only one school that any good Catholic boy could go to, and that was Notre Dame. And so I, you know, that experience probably started me thinking about it. My father died when I was a freshman in high school, but I was able to get a scholarship to Notre Dame, and I'm sure that that experience had something to do with it. Well, by the way, in that game, Notre Dame won 34-7. Air Force scored first on a pass interception for a touchdown, but it was all downhill for the Air Force after that.
Okay, and so and you were also at the very first Air Force game here in the Springs, but that's not Notre Dame, so we won't talk about that. But let's talk a little bit about Ara Parseghian and what you know of him.
Great football coach and really a great human being. I had very little contact with him as a student. I like to say that he said three words to me as a student. I was in a class. Every freshman had to take physical education, and you went through segments of different sports, and I was taking tennis lessons indoors in the middle of the winter, and he was jogging around the track at the and my tennis ball went a little too far and hit him, and he stopped, picked up the ball and threw it back to me and said, "Watch it, kid." And that was my interaction with Ara as a student. But he was a great motivator. When I was there, I think the team in the 4 years I was there, I think Notre Dame was 34-6.
Yeah, not a bad record. I mean, you know, a couple national championships under his belt as well, back in the mid '60s. So, you being an alum of Notre Dame, especially the time that you were there, what do you think? How do you think the Notre Dame family is feeling right now?
Very sad. You know, after he when he stepped down as coach, he spent years as a broadcaster. But he also had a son, and his son and daughter-in-law had three children that died of Niemann-Pick's disease, which is a terrible disease, a progressive deterioration of the nervous system of young people, and they die at a very young age. And that so seriously affected him that he joined with his son and daughter-in-law to start a foundation, and over the years they raised $45 million for research into Niemann-Pick's disease. And we haven't cured it, but we know a lot more about it, and there's some experimental drugs on the market now attempting to deal with it that would never happen but for his efforts. So he was a real humanitarian. The Notre Dame community regards him in that way. And I think there's a lot of Irish fans are pretty sad today.
It is a sad day. It's always sad when we see a legend. And we dealt with it this last year, not really the same with someone retiring, but when you lose a life like you did, Coach Parsigi, and he was 94 years old, but talked to someone earlier about how vibrant he was even last summer at a charity golf tournament at 93, that he was vibrant throughout his life and always willing to talk to anybody.
Well, absolutely. Even throw a tennis ball to a kid and say, watch it, kid.
Well, Coach, I called you Coach. Well, Mayor Southers, I want to thank you for joining us this morning on the University of Fish, and I'm sure we'll talk some more throughout the season and see how your Irish are doing.
Well, I'm hoping for the best. Last year was a little rough, Tim, but there's always tomorrow, right?
There is always tomorrow. Thank you, Mayor. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
We are joined now by Mike Varell, the South Bend Tribune, who knows the Irish inside and out. What has the mood been like in South Bend this week with the passing of Coach Parsigi?
Well, obviously it's a day that people didn't want to come, but I think also it's been just a celebration of life more than anything when it's a guy that's 94 years old, and I think people kind of knew that it was coming. He'd been in the hospital for a while. But, you know, it's not too much sadness here. I think it's more just an appreciation, a lot of tributes, people banding around him. The football team, you know, has his face has been up on the new video board for days now, ever since he passed. So, I mean, I think more it's just people celebrating his life, and that's going to continue on into this weekend with the mass that they're having for him and a memorial celebration on Sunday.
Now, talk to us about the effect that ERA had on that program.
I mean, it's kind of difficult to even describe it because it's just been such a huge overarching part of what this program is, obviously. Resurrecting it in 1964 and the 11 years that he was there, making them again into the powerhouse that they've become. And then even after he left that program, he was never really gone. I mean, he was someone who's always been around. He's always been accessible to the coaching staffs. Brian Kelly talks about how after every game that he's been at Notre Dame, up to including last year, he would get a handwritten note from ERA Parsigi after every game, just with notes, with encouragement. And this is something that ERA would do, you know, when he's 93 years old, watching every game, writing Brian Kelly a note. So he's a guy that's been, you know, part of this program, even after he left it, for decades and decades.
Now, let's transition a little bit to the current team. You brought up Coach Kelly. Is the seat a little bit hot in South Bend this year?
Oh, there's no doubt. I mean, coming off of a 4-8 season, I mean, that's unacceptable at Notre Dame. And I think the question is really what he needs to do to be secure here this season. And you talk to Athletics Director Jack Swarbrick, and there's nothing but support there. And he's talking about there being a long-term vision and being, you know, having complete faith in Brian Kelly beyond this season. But the fact is that if this is a 6-6 team or a 5-7 team or a 4-8 team like last year, I don't think Brian Kelly's going to be around. So the question is more, what is the breaking point? What number does he have to hit this year? And I think, you know, if he has 7 or 8 wins, he's probably still around, but no one really knows what that number is right now.
Well, let's talk about both sides of the ball. Offensively, what can we see from the Irish this year?
Well, it's going to be a lot faster. At least that's what their new offensive coordinator, Chip Long, says. I mean, they're trying to up the tempo. They're trying to run a lot of different plays and wear teams down. They have a new starting quarterback in junior Brandon Wimbush, a guy who's very highly touted, can run it, can throw it, someone they're very, very excited about. They have a ton of wide receivers. They have an experienced offensive line, a lot of running backs. So, you know, they're pretty stocked on the offensive side. It's just a matter of how will this scheme fit their personnel and will everybody stay healthy. But they've got lots to work with on the offensive side.
Now, when it comes to defense, you can't win games if you can't stop anybody. Will the Irish defense be improved from last year?
That's the question. I think the big person that everyone is kind of hanging their hat on at this point is new defensive coordinator Mike Elko, who is very well respected, came from Wake Forest, where he had a great run there with a lot less talent than they have at Notre Dame. But the defense certainly was not good last season, and there are holes this year that need to be filled as far as, you know, the defensive line. Can they stop the run? You know, what's the pass rush going to look like? What about the back end of the defense? Do they have safeties that are big-time guys that can step in? You know, Mike Elko has more talent to work with here than he did in Wake Forest, so there are definitely questions that have to be answered going into the season.
Well, now, if you pulled out your crystal ball, how do you see the Irish doing this year?
Well, we put out a preseason magazine every year that just came out at the beginning of July, and my prediction was 8-4. So, I mean, that's definitely a guess, more so a guess this year than in previous ones, just because this is a team that I feel like has such a wide range of possibilities. It could gel with all of these new coaches and pull off an 11-win season, or it could fall apart, you know, like you said, with Brian Kelly being on the hot seat and have another 4-8 season. I mean, this is a team that is very talented, but we just don't know right now how they're going to rebound from the 2016 season. So I have 8-4, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's much better or much worse.
Well, we know the Irish will have some big games this year and hopefully get the chance to talk to you again. Mike Varell from the South Bend Tribune, thank you for joining us today on the University of Fish.
No problem. I appreciate it.
When we come back, we're going to stick with the Notre Dame theme. We're going to take a break right now, but when we come back, Rudy, that's right, Rudy Rudiger, the real Rudy, not Sean Astin, right here on the University of Fish. You're listening to Extra Sports 1300. I'm the professor. We'll be right back.
Let's take a step out on the quad. Professor Fish is giving a lecture.
Hi, I'm Billy Sims, a 1978 Heisman Trophy winner from the University of Oklahoma, and you're listening to the University of Fish.
Boomer!
Welcome back to the University of Fish. Right now, we are joined by someone that everybody that loves college football knows, Daniel Rudy Rudiger. No, not Sean Astin, the real Rudy from the movie Rudy. Daniel, Rudy, which do you prefer?
Rudy. You know, my whole life is Rudy, so we'll stick with Rudy.
We'll stick.
Family members call you Danny, but outside that, it's Rudy.
We're not family, so we'll just stick with
right.
Rudy. How are you doing today, sir?
We're doing good. We're traveling, getting ready to visit the campus and go through the rituals of Aaron's funeral. And it's, I'm sure we'll see a lot of great people there in honor of Aaron. So this is going to be good for everyone to visit his last moment here.
It will be. It'll be a somber moment as well, but also a celebration of Coach Parsegian's life.
Of course.
Now, when you first got to campus, you went and talked to Coach Parsegian, and he gave you kind of a roadmap, and the people around Notre Dame give you a roadmap of what you need to do to get there. Talk about your time with Coach Parsegian.
Well, I didn't have much time with him, actually. It was a visit in his office early in the morning at 6 a.m., letting him know that I wanted to play and come out for the team, and that was at Holy Cross, and I'll see you when I get in. He says, that sounds good. We'll see you when you get here. He could have said, how old are you, or when's the last time you played football?
Or why are you in my office, or any of
those
things?
Why are you in my office? He's just accepted the fact that I was there. He was very professional and very it was a moment of, it's a game-changing moment, basically, that was very important for me as a young man, and he didn't take it from me. So that was the magic of Eric Parsegian.
And then so you worked your way to getting onto the Notre Dame campus, and, you know, you worked as hard as you could, And I'm going off facts from the movie, so if I am ever wrong, please correct me on this.
That's all right.
Because I know sometimes they, you know, take some fictional liberties just to make things more entertaining.
Exactly.
But you were a walk-on when Coach Parsegian was still there as a coach.
Correct.
Talk about his leadership of that team.
Well, he commanded something very important. He earned the respect of the players, and the players respected his leadership role as how he conducted himself as a coach, how he conducted himself as a human being, and the kids respected that. He was straightforward with the kids. He didn't talk behind your back. He told you right up front what he thought, what he felt, and the kids understood that. And he had a presence about him, because when you're in the locker room, you didn't have to see him. You just knew he was there. So that's the kind of presence he had.
Now, and in the movie, it has you, you know, talking to Coach Parsegian at the season. He says, you know, next year, and then Coach Devine comes in. What was that really like?
What was that like?
Yeah.
A grind.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah, grit it out, grind it out. And I have patience. That was where the Navy paid off, and a couple other experiences I had that paid off for that journey.
Now, you have went through, I mean, I know it was my dream to play college ball. I never got to fulfill that dream. You worked as hard as you could to make that dream come true. Now, I've watched both. Of course, I've seen the movie millions of times. I was talking to a friend the other day, and he's like going, you know, I can't even talk about the movie without getting emotional, because it does pull at the heartstrings. And I've watched the Sean Astin play there at the end of the game, and I've watched the True play. Now, the only inconsistency I can see between both of those is Sean Astin was offsides.
Sean wasn't offsides. I watched it. Well, close with him.
It looked like he lined up a little bit offsides, but he even got the leg.
Well, remember, the end of the game, this is interesting you say that, they never call him offsides the last play of the game.
No.
They won't never do that. So,
no.
Whether he was offside or not doesn't matter. They won't call it.
Oh, no, of course they won't. It was obviously, it was a Michigan friend that brought that up to me.
Right.
Now,
how about a Georgia Tech guy?
A Georgia Tech guy.
Yeah.
Now, how true to life was the movie?
Well, you know, when you say true to life, I'm not sure what you mean by that, but the moments are true. The journey was true. You can't have a true to life journey because you don't have that much time to tell the story.
Oh, no.
You only got 113 minutes, so you got to tell a story in a composite embellishment way to make it work. That means you have to do composites of characters and do embellishments of moments. That's the only way it works. Otherwise, it doesn't work. And you got to keep the movie moving. Otherwise, it'll be boring.
Exactly.
So it was. You had to bridge each scene. Each scene had to set up the next scene. So in life, it doesn't work that way.
Sometimes no, it doesn't.
It takes a little longer to get there. And so hopefully when you do a story like that or a movie like that, you're hoping the writer understands the message, which he did. That's why it worked. And the director understood it. So it worked because of that. Otherwise, it would never have worked. It would have been a corny, sappy movie. We didn't want that.
No. No, you didn't. Now, you are still going around motivating others. I mean, you motivated that team. You motivated yourself as well.
Well, you
did. Well, you know you did. I mean, because...
I get motivated by seeing people who work hard, who achieve things. I think that's the answer to that. It's not that you were a rah-rah guy. You just went out and did your job, and the people who... This is interesting because there are people who have the talent who kind of gave up. But also, when they saw a guy that was not supposed to be there work hard, it helped them maybe go to the next level. So it's a work effort. you're not supposed to be here, but you're here attitude. He's doing it. I should be doing it. And that's what connected to the team.
And it did very well. Now, I know your time is short. I know you're traveling to South Bend for for Coach Parsegian's memorial. So I want to thank you for coming on. If you were to offer one piece of advice to any listener, what would that be?
Never abandon your dream.
Those are great words from a great man. Rudy Rudiger, want to thank you for joining us today here on the University of Fish. Hope to talk to you again.
You bet. Have a great one. Thank you.
That's going to wrap up the University of Fish for this week. But next week, when we get together again for class, what we're going to do is we're going to go 11 through 20, the next 10 in the Fish's preseason top 25. I'm going to break those down for you. We'll talk to somebody from each team just like we did this week. And, of course, we're going to be one Saturday closer to college football being back. Get ready. It's going to be a great season. Coming up next on Extra Sports 1300, the other football show with Ryan Kaufman and Chris Braden. Right here on Extra Sports 1300, I am the professor, Tim Fisher. This is the University of Fish. Class dismissed.